Welcome to the Motoring Podcast, your weekly discussion of motoring news. This is episode 122. It's not a fawning Model 3 launch special. On Tuesday, the 1st of August 2017. Hello, I'm Alan.
Hello, I'm Andrew. And this week we will instead be talking about how PSA owns Opel and Vauxhall now. The end of days in 23 years. A first for the show. Another first for the show. And we'll get straight into how PSA owns Vauxhall Opel. So they've finally signed on the dotted line. Everything, T's have been dotted, I's have been crossed, and all those sort of things. And now, as expected, and as was rumoured, by the end of July, it'd be done. And it has been done.
It has.
So that is hopefully good news for Vauxhall.
Here's hoping. Well,
but we still don't know why and what's going to happen, and you know, because there's so many rumors about things like, will they split off and be the electric vehicle arm, will they do this specific thing, that specific thing, because they just look like they're competing against each other, and that's worrying.
It is quite weird. So PSA now have 17% of the European market, making them a pretty major player, funnily enough. Nobody knows what's happening about the British factories in Luton and Ellesmere Port. I don't think anybody knows what's happening. It's literally just been signed. There will be a lot of transformation to take place in there. The deal was £1.9 billion, £1.2 billion-ish of which was for the actual car manufacturing and the models. And all that stuff that we think of. Another, and this was a weird thing, I think it must be the rounding in the Autocar story, linked in the show notes. Another 800 million was for the financial side. That bit is still not finalised. They're still working their way through that, because the finance stuff is way more complex than the manufacturing.
Have they had that approved, that bit? I know they'd had the manufacturing side of things approved, but have they had the finance bit approved? Do we know? Is that part of the holdup?
Can't remember. I think it's the various loops you have to jump through for the approval. I'm not going to scroll back through. Okay. There's a really long, really informative article by Greg Cable on Autocar that will be the story linked in the show notes. And if you want to know the exact set of that, it just says the acquisition of GM Financial's European operations will be finalised later this year. Doesn't say anything about that. What else? What I didn't realise, possibly because I wasn't really interested and wasn't really paying attention, I'm so sorry, was that the Crossland X and the Grandland X, two of the sillier X-named models, were already based loosely on PSA platforms. I didn't realise that the Grandland X platform is related to that in the Peugeot 3008. So, obviously, this has been going for far longer than we thought about it, really. Or at least there's been some level of...
Because I thought somebody had tweeted a picture on a launch or a first drive, and they showed the GM controls for the aircon, and then below was another set. And I'm sure the tweet said something... Here's the GM aircons and here's the PSA aircon. And I forgot to save it, and I thought, that can't be right, that there'd be...
Same.
But there did seem to be two separate sets of buttons and stuff that looked quite similar in...
At least in layout.
...what they were meant to be doing. Yeah, and colours and stuff, but...
Would make a lot of sense. Make a lot of sense that was the case. So no, I hadn't realised that until I just noticed it as part of this Great Cable article. So a bit more tie up there than I was expecting.
Mm.
Next piece of
one more bit of follow up.
Just one more piece of follow up. You'll be relieved to know, folks, that it's relatively Dieselgate light. Thank goodness after last week. The new London taxi, the London Electric Vehicle Company TX, is now available to order. It is on sale. Well, it is orderable from 55,599 pounds. I'm allowed a couple of those tonight. Which seems like quite a lot, but when you realise that 90% of buyers are expected to opt for £177 a week over 5 years on the finance deal, which is a return trip from central London. Well, it's two singles from central London to Heathrow, roughly, a week will pay for that. So that's over 5 years. That sounds like quite a lot of money, but when you think that it is basically the tool of the business, it's really not so bad. Not only that, but that price includes servicing for up to 3 years or 90,000 miles, and a warranty for 3 years or 120,000 miles in there. On top of all of that,
they're confident in that it'll work. Then,
yeah. Well, they've got to offer these guarantees, or nobody will move to them. So it makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense there. And they also reckon that the new model will cost drivers about £50 a week in fuel instead of about £150. So that's pretty hefty. Yeah. Supposedly the outgoing model, the TX4 was £167 a week over a 4 year period, as opposed to 177 over a 5 year. So it's not quite apples and apples being compared there, so I'm not quite sure how that works out. We've talked before about how these are range extender hybrids, etc., and share many, many bits with fellow vehicle in the Geely stable from Volvo.
Yeah, it probably won't be too long till there's a full electric model out from them, will it?
I would imagine it's going to happen within about 23 years.
23 years? Well, what's happening in 23 years, Alan?
I don't know. There was just some muttering. I was really busy, and and I came back to Twitter, and people were on about 2040.
Oh, did you mean how the fact that the world will end in 23 years? That one?
That's the one.
The hysteria where basically people ran around going, for a day.
They're going to crash all our cars! Yeah, that one.
Yeah. No petrol or diesel after 2040, except hybrids. So therefore it will be. And therefore,
is it still hybrid?
Perhaps overreacted.
No, hybrids still hybrids are exempt. Hybrids exempt. So, in other words,
yes, because the problem was on the leak of the information from the government, they didn't have enough brains to be able to explain it properly, so people could report it properly. So they said petrol and diesel cars, a bit similar to another article.
Was that to do with the well-known
press release we had not so long ago that made it sound as though there will be no more petrol and diesel vehicles from a certain manufacturer in Sweden. However, that wasn't what they were actually saying.
Yeah. I missed that little bit. So the other thing is, people, it's new sale of new ones. Whatever it is.
Yes, they're not coming to steal your car.
They are not going to take our V6s away. Okay? It's sale of new ones. Now, yeah. That's all I can say. To be honest, there have been many, many articles. You might have seen I responded, those of you who are foolish enough to ever look at LinkedIn. That includes me these days, which is kind of freaky. We'll see that I responded to an article on LinkedIn written by a friend of the show in which I disagreed with him. And I continue to disagree with him. I'm sorry, Adam. But actually, you know, it's not a great knee-jerk thing. The car has been around for about 120 years now. You're talking another a fifth of that time. By that point, a fifth of the development of cars can happen. A fifth of that life cycle is going to be tacked on the end from now before this happens. If you think how much has changed in cars in 23 years, you know, it really is a massive sea change of stuff has happened. There's time for that to happen again. This fight, everyone's going, oh, batteries aren't enough. Well, I'm really sorry, but just because it's internal combustion engines doesn't mean that we're going to have to sit and wait for our cars to charge for ages. One of the things that's coming in Formula E in a few years' time, it's one of the reasons why Qualcomm is such a big sponsor, is the ability to charge in the road as you're going along. It's one of the things that's happening in a few years' time. I can't remember exactly which year. Okay, but once they've got a car that runs all race, the next stage is, okay, we want to be able to have charging lanes and speed up and slow down and to add an extra level in there. So induction charging and the ability to charge with stuff under the roadway becomes viable once we're at that kind of level. And the technology exists. But the real one for me is hydrogen, the great stepping stone hydrogen. Now, the problem with hydrogen aren't the cars. There are two manufacturers you can go to and you can lease or you can buy hydrogen cars in this country. Oh, you, me, any of us now can go do this. And the thing is that the problem is lack of infrastructure. The infrastructure in this case is dead easy because these things are basically containerized. Two trucks roll up, a crane comes along, lifts them off, shove them together, plug them in, another truck comes up, fills them with hydrogen. It's ready to go. This is not difficult. It is not rocket science at all. It is completely
deployable. And you know what? You know what? If only somebody had thought about something similar for petrol and diesel.
You mean like these stations around?
If there was only some sort of system that was similar to that, so therefore no one would have to, you know, adapt themselves psychologically and adapt the way that they use the vehicle. If only that had happened already.
Hydrogen.
You know, it's just
hydrogen right at the minute to run the Hyundai hydrogen. iX35, really, I'm going to say first or second generation hydrogen car. That's traditional hydrogen car, because I'm actually leaving out the Rasa one from Wales right at the minute in my thinking here. So that's three manufacturers.
River Simple,
thank you. To run it on hydrogen right now with minimal infrastructure, minimal fueling, the price, the miles per gallonness, all that kind of stuff, is on par with premium petrol, 98 octane petrol, right at the minute, and that without economies of scale, with minimal infrastructure, so people can just judge what they want, really. And that's what we need to move on for. I mean, I know that the Fraser Nash fuel cell taxi has gone very, very quiet. With the LEVC stuff, the electric vehicle company stuff. But there are so many ways. It's not because we're just going to be limited to the current 150-ish mile to 200-mile battery range that everyone is completely up in arms about, which, let's face it, covers the vast majority of people's vast majority of travel.
Exactly. I mean, there was so much hysteria about all of this that facts and sense and just taking a step back and thinking it through, actually there's plenty of people saying it's not enough quick enough.
It's
because of the way that legislation is already moving, that they're tightening up on emissions, for example, has meant that manufacturers have all turned around and basically said amongst themselves to the public, we cannot do this without having some sort of alternative fuel source combined or alternative powertrain, i.e. electric. Otherwise, we cannot hit the targets we are being given by the EU. Mm-hmm. So that's another reason why the Volvo statement wasn't actually as groundbreaking as it made out to be, because they have to do this, otherwise they cannot continue to sell cars.
And there's enough...
Because unless they have found some super fantastic technology that will make the engines run so clean without anything else being in there to help it out, then this is the only viable option that manufacturers have at the minute that is economical enough to be able to mass produce.
Yeah, great.
So, you know, we're talking right now, we've got city cars or small family cars that will do 200 miles on a single charge, 200 plus on a single charge, you know, 23 years. The advancements in battery technology just in the last 5, 6, 7 years, from you were doing 50 to 70 miles type thing to now, you know, everyone's expecting a minimum of 150 to that, you know, we it's not going to be easy. No one says it's going to be easy. However, we have the technological ability amongst all the manufacturers. There is the skill, and now this is giving them a constraint.
It's a tough...
And usually, I will see more countries doing this because other countries have made these statements and other cities have made these statements. So therefore, these constraints are being given to the manufacturers, but they are being given quite a big lead time on stuff they're already working on.
There's going to be no excuse by the time. No. Now, yeah, there's going to be no excuse. So, suck it up. Basically, that's where I'm going with this.
Yeah, because I mean,
it's going to happen at some point. It might as well happen sooner rather than later.
I mean, because one of the other, and it just does feel like it's a cliche being wheeled out. Oh, the electricity supply will have blackouts, blah, brownouts. We cannot cope. We've only got 10%, etc., etc. And there was an article on Twitter. I think it was Tom Callow who tweeted it. That'll be in the show notes that I encourage people to read, because this is actually using some sort of facts and not feelings and perception and stuff. But what it basically says...
It's just worth mentioning that Tom Cal does work for Chargemaster, although he's been saying this kind of stuff for longer than he's worked for Chargemaster.
Yes, that is true. But the upshot of the article is that it's going to add only 10% to the demand.
Yeah.
And not the, you know, apocalyptic, inspiring moments where we'll all be attacked by zombies because the lights have gone out type scenarios that was being painted.
Do you know what would happen if we all turned up at the petrol stations at the same time to refill our cars, Andrew? There wouldn't be enough petrol. Not enough pay. We
what?
Wouldn't be able to get to the pumps. It would be.
You mean we'd have to wait?
Yes. Do you know what? We would. We wouldn't be able to recharge our cars. Incredible, isn't it? What a leap.
Because we all run out at exactly the same time as well, don't we?
All the time. And I always need to charge my car every night at exactly 6 p.m. Whenever the ad break is in Coronation Street, when everyone is putting their kettle on, that is the moment when I need to charge my car. Sorry, refill it with petrol. Yeah, that's it. All three of them.
Well, I'll tell you what, Alan.
Yes.
Should we test out?
What you mean?
Should we test
like,
out
take...
how realistic it is to drive a regular electric vehicle with a regular range that isn't, you know, silly mm-hmm. money to buy, and see, I don't know, how far we can get round Britain in it.
Yeah, I think that sounds like a pretty good deal. But I've only got a week to do it in, is the challenge.
Okay, so say we set off on Monday the 20th? I think the Monday the 27th.
Yeah.
Or 28th of August. And then we finish on the Saturday. How about Saturday the 2nd then?
That sounds pretty good. Of September. That sounds like we'd be making it very difficult for ourselves by starting on a bank holiday Monday.
We probably would.
So that...
I tell you, to add to that, let's go south as well.
Oh, right.
Why don't we start in my town,
yeah,
and we'll go south.
It's a plan.
And let's see how viable it is to drive a regular electric vehicle, not 350-mile range for 100-plus thousand pounds.
You mean something that costs maybe about £25,000 to £27,000?
Yeah, something like that.
Okay, let's do it.
Let's see what it's like. Let's see what the infrastructure is like, how realistic it is. Our assumptions that we have been prattling on about for quite some time, mm-hmm. where we say people don't drive as much as they think they do, electric vehicles will actually get them further than they think they will, and the infrastructure is actually not so bad now. Everyone's thinking 5-10 years ago. That's what they're thinking is the current state. So why don't we go and back up our words and our bravado? Mm-hmm. And let's see how often Alan has to push an electric car to the nearest charging point for me.
Yeah, and if you think we're complete morons, then whenever we run out of electricity somewhere up near Scourie, up near Cape Wrath in Scotland, you can have a really good laugh, because trust me, I won't be laughing at that point.
Alan is very, very worried about Scotland.
That top bit. I'm not so worried about Scotland in general. I'm like, from like Wick and Tongue, there is a place called Tongue. Its main export are little stickers that read I Heart Tongue. To kind of Ullapool. That's the bit that scares the willies out of me. And it's a fair chunk of that North Coast 500. So yes, we're going to be doing that. We'll have more details as we get closer. And as we get some little bits firmed up, including our route and roughly where we expect to be. That's a plan.
That's the first road trip for the show.
It is. And boy, are we biting off a dumb one. The number of people who think that we're not actually going to make it is quite huge, including the person who's lending us the car. Anyway, one last thing before we get to the Patreon call to action, which minorly adds to the doom and gloom, but isn't really a surprise to me, is that the Department of the Environment strategy outlines something which, as I say, wasn't really a huge surprise to me. Possibly won't be a huge surprise to you, but there is a paragraph which suggests, and please don't think this is confirmed, but it suggests that there may well be a rise in taxation on the horizon for diesel vehicles. As pointed out by Alex Grant on Twitter, and let me just, it's paragraph 20, and it says, "The government is clear that we must maintain discipline on public spending. Measures to improve air quality will therefore be funded through changes to the tax treatment for new diesel vehicles, or through reprioritising within existing departmental budgets. Further details on changes into the tax regime will be announced later in the year." Now, who thinks that civil servants are going to voluntarily reprioritise their existing departmental budgets? Yeah, quite. So the chances are that a change in the tax treatment for new diesel vehicles is on the way later in the year. Now, we can pretty much assume that it's not going to be that they're going to drop the taxation given they're trying to raise money. So just really worth...
Oh, I had a tenner on they were going to drop it.
Sorry.
Blast.
So just watch out for that if you're thinking about them. I mean, it comes under that demonization of diesel that we've talked about before.
And that's such a silly, silly thing, isn't it? Because I think there's steps I don't think people will fully appreciate what they're actually saying from a cost perspective. And I have to reiterate once again, we all want clean air. We all don't want to be polluting people, etc., etc. You know, that's not acceptable either. However, by making these steps, everyone has to appreciate everything is going to start costing us more money.
Yeah.
Because if you are charging a firm more money to own a vehicle so they can deliver stuff to us, they have to pass that cost on. Therefore, we at the end will take that hit, which therefore is a bit of a double whammy for the government because they get more VAT and stuff like that. So, you know, they do win out again. And we really need to appreciate that because I've heard talks about why aren't subsidies on, say, refrigerated vehicles, why aren't they being looked at because they use a diesel generator on their cooling mm-hmm. thing, so they have two diesel engines. What, you know, maybe red diesel needs to be looked at and how that is
farmers
dealt with. Which is a separate conversation, but you know we impact. You know, we're talking more and more costs. We're all going to have to face the fact that this is all going to cost us more. Yeah. You know, just to get normal stuff that you don't think is connected to a car or a vehicle.
Yeah, so just it's worth pointing out and coming in here with my haulage company director hat on, that, you know, we haul stuff for the oil industry. It's what we do. And when there's a hike in fuel prices, then we pass that on to our customer, the oil company. The oil services company, who in turn will pass that on to the oil company, who in turn will pass it on to all of us in our cost of our fuel. And it becomes a vicious spiral, don't get me wrong. But we need that. We need to do that bit at the start, because otherwise we've got 40-odd employees who we can't afford to pay. That we've got nice new shiny trucks, so they're as environmentally friendly as possible, that we have to pay for. So don't forget all of that. Red diesel will be painful when that happens. If that happens, that will be painful, because that goes straight to the farmer. And you can bet that old Farmer Giles up the field there will be whacking a fair amount of his cost on because of the increasing cost in red diesel. You know.
Well, I mean, just that's part of much of a big conversation that's going on about subsidies for farmers is as one branch of Great Britain PLC. And I think what we all have to appreciate is it's one thing sitting there and saying, you know, this needs to be fixed, so therefore tax more or implement a change that costs companies more. We have to understand and appreciate that that will have an immediate knock-on effect, that stuff will cost us more. Mm-hmm. So, you know, no one can bleat or moan or complain if suddenly the food in the supermarket goes up because it costs more to deliver.
Yeah.
Or because there's suddenly a massive tax on diesel that is perhaps disproportionate but looks good from a voting point of view.
Yes, quite.
And this is my worry when the politicians are involved. And I will stop now before...
Yes, we've been a bit ranty in this first half, haven't we? That's bad. And really, really, we shouldn't be sitting there talking about costs of stuff going up when this is the point in the show, when we're about to ask people for money. You'll notice our challenge doesn't involve the cost of fossil fuels. Yes, this is that point in the show.
Directly. There is no search.
Directly, yes, quite. Well, I remind you of our Patreon in a way that you, a way you can support the Motion Podcast by donating a small amount of money every month that helps us do this kind of thing and at least contributes a little bit towards us trying to do challenges and stuff like that and hosting and all sorts of other really boring stuff that has nothing to do with cars. If you'd like to know more, then please head to motoringpodcast.com and hit on the orange Become a Patron button that's there proudly at the right-hand side of our front page. We're really trying. It would be great if we could build up and add a new patron a month. That would just be fantastic. Whatever level you're at, if we'd add one more person each month, that would be just great. Whenever you join in the month, then the first payment doesn't come out until the first of the following month. So don't panic and don't worry about feeling you have to wait until payday on this, because it does happen. It does happen just after most people's paydays anyway. It's very grown up and very, very sensible like that. There are a number of different suggested levels. From a dollar upwards, whichever band you fall into, then we will be sure to... We'll do our very best to deliver what we've said we'll deliver to you in each of those bands. And that could include watching us record this live via YouTube, should you decide to.
Lucky them. Lucky them. Don't say it. Call it down this time. Not this week.
This is true. Yes. Watching us on YouTube is a bit like
see the magic is a bit, that happens is, behind the scenes.
It's like listening to us but without the audio quality. Okay, we understand that not everyone is,
and the editing.
Yeah, slice off the front, slice off the ends, stick some logos on. It'd be great. Not everyone has the ability to do this, to donate money. We completely understand that, so please don't forget to like, rate, leave feedback via the podcast player of your choice, and tell your mates who might be interested in this kind of thing. Anytime people ask me what a podcast is at work, I take their work phone from them and subscribe them, because I'm nice like that. That still counts as organic, doesn't it? I made a claim this week about it being organic growth, and then I'm saying that out loud and thinking, ooh, maybe that doesn't count. But yes, it's one at a time, very slowly.
You didn't buy them.
No, I didn't.
You walked up to a person and just took the phone off them.
That's all right. That's perfectly okay. It's reasonable marketing. Anyway, should we talk about Formula E? Let's move on from this.
Yes, come on, because it was.
It was the end of the season.
Finale
to the season in Montreal. People were a bit worried about what.
Quite an exciting season.
Well, yes. Well, it was the exciting finale to an exciting season. People were slightly nervous about what Montreal would be like, because loads of people went to New York the other week and a fortnight ago, and folk were worried that Montreal just wouldn't hold the same allure to people. It seems that seems to be plenty of people turned up. Looking at what little TV coverage I could actually get my TV to see, I must get my aerial fixed before next season. But it was a doubleheader. The distinct lack of Battersea this year and next year, and a doubleheader. Taking over there. So, I mean, it got really exciting right from the very start, right from practice, when Sebastian Buemi took a fantastically hard shunt into a wall and almost destroyed his car.
He tried to create a new line for himself, didn't he?
He tried to create a new car. He did, yes. It was very much creation.
Heck of a crash.
It was one
that
heck
looked
of
to be
a
some
shunt.
Proper G's being
well, it was,
thrown around.
It was bad enough that it damaged the monocoque, the battery pack, the gearbox, loads of bits and pieces on his Renault Edams car. Pretty serious stuff. He went on to qualify, but then he was disqualified overall from race one, losing 12 points. When his rebuilt car hadn't, when it was found that his rebuilt car, pardon me, hadn't reached the minimum minimum weight of 880 kilograms. Supposedly, the reason for this is that there is a difference in the weight of the batteries depending on which battery you have.
He was using new stuff, wasn't he?
Yeah, and there's a difference in the weight
of the
monocoque.
That's what the blame was being put.
Well, they
down
had
to
change it because he damaged it all. So it had to be new stuff, and timing meant that he couldn't get it on the weighbridge in time. So they were 3 kilos down.
So they guessed how much they needed to throw in, didn't they? Of ballast,
yeah, they did.
And they've underguessed.
They underguessed by 3 kilos, yeah. Yeah, so he got disqualified after the race. To be honest, if he hadn't been disqualified,
was race one.
If he hadn't been disqualified for that, I really feel that, humorous though it is, he should probably have had some pretty serious markings down for his behaviour towards other drivers afterwards, because.
On live TV.
Live on TV, in the middle of an interview, he lashes into 3 different drivers, accusing them of all crashing into him on purpose.
Until somebody quietly comes up and says, that's the wrong guy. You want him,
do you want him down there.
It was him. And he comes up and goes, oh, yeah, what am I supposed to do? I either hit you in the back or I,
what do you want me to do?
Take a chance and maybe I miss you.
Yeah. Maybe I miss you, or maybe I just knock your wing off. Which would you want? Oh, just knock the wing off, just knock the wing off, just knock the wing off. So hilariously, in race two, he ended up qualified just in front of two of the people that he had a real go at and was a bit of a prat towards. And unfortunately, someone knocked into the back of him early on, meaning he was damaged, which was not intentional.
That actually looked to me for the first time ever of a driver cracking a little bit under pressure like you see in Formula One happening. Not just what happens on the track, but outside the track.
Yeah.
Or outside the race.
Yeah.
And after. And that sort of, to me, adds a bit of weight to the whole, this is very serious.
Hmm.
The guys doing it are taking it very seriously, although they come across like they're having fun on social media because they actually engage in social media. But that's a different... We've said it many times how we think that's one of the positives.
If you want to read about that, I do have a corporate paid-for blog by my normal employer writing about a little bit about that on LinkedIn as well. Sorry.
I'll see if I can dig that out, and if I can tomorrow morning, I will.
Put feels it a bit cheesy. I didn't never publicized it on here because it does end with "Why not buy a tool?" But yeah,
they don't have to then if they get to the end. but it showed the pressure that the drivers felt they were under.
It does,
because the way he reacted, but it was, some of it was self inflicted because he went off and did other stuff, didn't he? He did WEC.
Yeah. Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
But if you're not there for all the races, forgetting the disqualifications he had, he probably wouldn't have been in that position.
Yeah. So, in the end, in race two...
So, anyway, who won race one?
Oh, I can't remember now. I don't actually have that written down. I've got race two's results written down.
Degrassi.
It was Lucas that won race one. Sorry, I'm...
He won race one, but what also, because this was the only bit I managed to see of it over the weekend, so that's why I know about it for a change. Mm. But because what was really key is because he got pole, he got 3 extra points.
Yes.
So therefore, that meant he finished the end of race one, or day one of the 2 day races, in the lead for the championship.
Yeah, only just.
Just.
And that meant that he could finish 7th in the second race. Which was won by Jean-Éric Vergne, Felix Rosenqvist coming in second, and Jose Maria. Jose Maria, I can't read your name because I've written it so badly in there. Lopez came in first, second, and third. But he came in seventh, and that still meant that he had enough mercifully to a win by 24 points over Sebastian Buemi, win the championship, and become the third Formula E world champion in 3 seasons, which is great, because one of the things that people don't necessarily know is that when the series was still in pre-infancy, when they had one car, then Lucas Degrassi was the original test driver for Formula E. So actually, in season one, he went into season one with more time in the car than anyone else. Although the car had evolved so much across the development time. But he was the original development driver, so it's kind of cool that he's had a chance. He has actually won eventually, because he's been very, very close a couple of times last 2 seasons. So yes, excellent, and he's a very nice chap too. So.
So that's the end of the sports.
That's the end of the sports
for the season.
That's the end of the Formula E season. It starts again in Hong Kong in. Oh, Graham told me the other day. I can't remember. Oh, the other thing in Formula E news, of course, is Porsche joining.
Yes,
which I maybe kind of knew before the announcement. There we go. Which is impressive and unexpected, to be perfectly honest. I was not expecting it to happen. I only found out because I made a joke about something else. But
well, that completely ruins the whole one Volkswagen group per race series.
Yeah, I know. It was like, no, you're kidding. Look, they're broken. What happened to the one Volkswagen group per race series? And so it was Porsche special. I don't think they count. I think any time we talk about Volkswagen group, apart from Porsche, should be the general caveat. Unless we're talking about Dieselgate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So,
yes.
And then it's Audi's anyway. Fault, apparently.
And then it's
not
Audi's
the first
fault,
for the show.
Totally, yes. There is a first. So, do you want to explain what's,
our second first.
What's happened?
Well, you know, from time to time we are lucky enough to be loaned vehicles to test, usually for a week or two, mm-hmm. Which is very, very gratefully received from the manufacturers. Well, we have our first long-term car test.
Ooh, well, that's just
I feel
like
there should be some sort of fanfare there.
What, just like the big magazines have, yeah?
Yeah, just like the big people do, like the grown-ups.
Yeah, I know. That's what this lies in. You and the people don't steal the chocolate croissants. Yeah.
So we have Subaru to thank for this first for the show. In this instance. Because I have a Subaru Outback 2-litre diesel SE Premium Linartronic.
Lineartronic.
For a month. Lineartronic anyway, sorry, yes.
Oh, come and speak take it properly. Back.
I know, well, I may
if
have
they can
to
find
run
you.
To the other end of the country to hide.
Yeah. So, yeah, so that's what you've got. So do you want to tell us a little bit more about it now that we've worked out how you pronounce the name?
Yes, I can try that, certainly.
Go on, then.
This is £34,995 on the road, which is, and it's the top of the range. Although I say top of the range starts at £32,995 for the 2.5 litre petrol. So it's not a massive range as far as cost goes, or cost range goes. Doing a quick check for people who like to pay monthly, on Subaru's own website, their PCP deal with a £3,500 contribution, which they are doing at the moment. And if you have a deposit of exactly £6,305, which is a very...
It's very exact, isn't it?
Very precise amount. You will pay £379 a month for 49 months. And the first month is... the first 12 months, even, are interest-free, and then it's 6.9%. So that's to give you an idea of the sort of monthly cost.
That's very complex to work out.
Yes, the PCP stuff is very complex to work out. Mm-hmm. But you do need to read all the documentation carefully.
Yes.
I think is what everybody needs to do. So this is a 2-litre boxer diesel, because they have a boxer engine. It has 150 of the horses, which gives out 350 of the torques.
Are they metric horses?
Yes.
Right, just checking. People do actually like to know, believe it or not, yes.
And through the Lineartronic, continuously variable transmission, which means there's no noticeable gear changes. It's not like you... as Alan has described before, there is a cone and a band runs up and down continuously to give the... Are you right there, Alan? I don't mean to kill you off.
Yeah,
I hope I haven't ruined your description. Move on. I was going to ask you to describe it again, but I thought that would be cruel and unnecessary. the one I've got is in a rather fetching, a platinum metallic grey. And it's on rather smart 18-inch alloys, which look nice when they're clean. They are not clean at the moment. They're not clean at all. CO2-wise, this is 159 grams per kilometre. And so that will mean for the first year you pay £500 to the government. And then because of the wonderful way they've decided the VED, it's £140 a month after that.
So, £140 a year after that. £140
yes.
£140 a year, yeah. Cool. So what have you done? What have you done in it so far? And how well has it done what you've asked it to do?
We have gone on a road trip. We have gone down to the southwest in it, and therefore we have done motorway miles. Mm-hmm. We have done A roads, we've done B roads, we've done little lanes with lots of grass in the middle of them.
Ah,
almost
so perfect
green laning
for an
in
outback.
Places.
You couldn't have asked for a better
exactly.
car for that.
No, exactly. And it has swallowed all our junk easily. Uh-huh. That all fits, no problem at all, to the point where it's not above the rear cover, because there's some fancy bit of extra stowage underneath, because there's no actual spare wheel.
Oh, right, okay.
So I can put things underneath and pretend I'm all clever. And that was one of the bits that I've really liked about it. It's only a small, tiny thing, but there is a hook on a bit of string that I can keep up the boot lid, the boot floor up while I am putting things in and taking them out without having to hold it up with one hand. Now, that sounds possibly silly, and why am I fixating on it? When you are taking many bags in and out as many times as I have done in the last 4 days, this is an incredibly useful thing that has shown there's a little bit of thought, and it is only what it needs to be. It is no more. It's not a fancy aluminium chain or anything. This is just a hard-wearing bit of string and a hook that will hook nicely onto the place. And it's got its own little area under the boot lid, so it's not just left dangling about. It all gets put away neatly. And you know I like a little bit of clever thought in a car.
Yes, I do.
And that just shows a little bit of thought, and I like that.
So, you say you did motorway miles and stuff. I have a copy of the spec sheet in front of me, so I happen to know that this is one of the models fitted with the EyeSight deck that Subaru is so keen on telling us how clever and how smart it is, and even let us try to crash into other stuff to show how clever and smart it was. How did you? Because what we've never done is actually, you know, I've tried it all sorts of places, but haven't actually tried it on the motorway. So, because it acts as active cruise and lane keeping and all that stuff, doesn't it?
There's no lane keeping assist.
Oh, okay, right.
There is lane departure warning.
Right.
But yes, there is an active cruise which worked really well.
Okay, cool.
I was in, at one point I was testing it when we were in a lot of stop-start traffic because, hey, British motorways, a lot of stop-start traffic, and for a long portion of time, even though I was poised, primed, I was not touching the brake or the accelerator, and the car was doing it all for me.
Mm-hmm. And did that make it more relaxing or not?
Yes, it did. That made it much, much easier because because you can change how sensitive or how close you get to the vehicle in front through the steering wheel. You can change how far away it senses and then makes its changes. And I set it reasonably far apart, but it would sort of you would almost coast up towards the vehicle, and then there would be a nice gap that if they stopped and you had to pull out, you could do that easily without worrying about, you know, like you would if you weren't in, say, I don't know, an Audi, mm-hmm. where you're incapable of getting more than a foot from the boot be in front of you.
Okay.
And it worked really well. It worked really well at speed. It worked really well at slow speed. I was very impressed with it, and it made the drive down on the motorway side of things so much easier. And it felt like it was a human doing the accelerating and braking as well. It didn't take ages to get you back up to speed. And the braking felt very natural. Not, here we go, oh, we've hit a marker, right, we slam on, and then everybody goes, oh, what's going on? Mm. It wasn't that at all. It was progressive when it sensed the vehicles. And then, obviously, if things started slowing quicker, it obviously pressed harder, as you would.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it just felt very natural from that point of view.
So was it quite passenger-friendly? Because I know that that's one of the challenges, certainly with earlier versions of these, is that sometimes trickier passengers complain that it's too jerky in and out.
It wasn't doing that. It wasn't doing the jerkiness.
Okay.
I mean, there was a couple of times. The one thing I will say is the warning for braking it's not quite sensitive, but it is perhaps. There was a couple of times it triggered just a fraction of. I mean, it really is a fraction of a second before I was pressing the brake. Mm-hmm. So that gave me confidence that it's paying attention.
Okay.
If you know what I mean. Because it went off, I was going, I was braking anyway, but you've spotted this. That's fine. Yeah. That's okay. I have a bit of trust in this system. I'm not saying I will just let it. I'm not saying it's an autonomous driving thing. It is a driver assist.
Right. Which is the right term, really. I think even we will agree that that's the right term. Okay.
Yes.
Any surprises, things that you weren't expecting?
Surprises, it doesn't have parking sensors.
And even at the rear?
big old no. It's got a camera.
Oh, okay. Well,
rear, I am not. I'm not as worried because it's a flat back.
Aha.
I know where the back is. It's the front I'm a bit more nervous about because the bonnet goes down and then there's a bit on the front of the car with a bit of plastic cladding,
yeah,
type effecty thing in front of the bumper around the lights. So I'm very conscious that, you know, it's a press car. What don't you do in a press car? You don't scratch the press car.
Yes.
And I'm very conscious of, you know, where the nose is, and because I haven't got a bleep saying, "Oh, you're getting a bit close," that I'm more sensitive to that than I would be if there was a sensor in there. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so but I'm sure
you. But I'm a bit surprised there isn't anything in the front.
Okay, fair enough. Okay, is that it?
I'd say that it's our experiences and the feedback from the beta group is that it's very comfy.
Cool.
Tons of room. And everybody has been absolutely fine all the way down.
Fab. Okay, well, that's high praise.
No travel issues.
Cool. Cool.
So we will catch up on this next week.
Yes. So
because we are going to do one for the 4 weeks we've got it. We will do a little segment in each of the shows, and we'll go into a bit more detail on another aspect of the vehicle and any other things that have cropped up during my time with the car. That is
fantastic.
What we will do.
Cool. So we shall come back for installment two of Andrew and his Outback.
I might know how to describe the transmission system.
Yes. Well, why don't you take that away as some homework next week? See if you can describe a CVT system. That'd be good.
Well, no, it just works for me. That's fine.
Go and watch the Subaru instructional.
But I'm not
video.
The only one. Yes, there is that. I may need to throw that in just to help balance out how awful I've been. But I'm not the only one who has driven a different vehicle to normal, Alan.
Well, yes. Last week I had an unofficial test car, or rental, as they're also known. it was an Opel Mokka X 1.4T Navi, I believe, according to
Mokka
the hire
X?
Sheet. Say again?
What's a Mokka X?
So it is the new version of the what over here is the Vauxhall Mokka X, because they put X on the end of their model names at Vauxhall and Opel these days, because that's the cool thing to do. It makes them seem mysterious and strange.
Oh, so it's not like it's a larger version or anything.
No,
like that.
No, it's now
just thrown an X on the name.
It used to be the Mokka, now it's the Mokka X in there.
Okay,
and it was metallic orange. And do you know what? The reason I brought it up here was because it was surprisingly pleasant. Okay, I didn't do a huge number of miles in the car.
Are you all right?
But I got it, and I'd ordered a premium Golf, is actually what I'd ordered. And so I was expecting an E3 or a Mercedes-Benz A-Class or something like that. That's what I was expecting, and I got an Opel Mokka, and I went, oh, really? And he went, yes, this is what you get for that change. So I ended up with a flipping Opel Mokka in orange, which, by the way, was a real asset, because if you park in a German car park, every car is grey or white or black. So actually having this sort of tall pustule of orangeness is really a bit of a benefit when it comes to finding the sodding thing again. But I really liked it. It was nice. I've just been really rude and then say I really liked it. But I did. It was comfortable. You had a good view out. All the controls, certainly in the left-hand drive version, were perfectly read. The steering was nice. The gear shift was like stirring kind of rubbery paint. It was not good. But I'm prepared to give that a slight buy, given I was using my right hand rather than my left hand, although I do swap between sides of the car quite often, so it doesn't bother me too much.
Yeah, but sharp gear changes are not what that car's supposed to be about.
But it was more a case of finding the correct one was the challenge, because I was driving smoothly because I had passengers and stuff. Yeah,
right, that does actually... Yes, that does matter.
Yeah, is that third? Is it fifth? It could be either. But again, it's been...
As long as it's not reverse, you're all
but
right.
It had been a rental for 8,000, 9,000 kilometres, so you never know what's happened to these cars. So they're possibly the worst things ever to base a review on. But there was some stuff I really liked. The stereo was reasonably intuitive, plugged in my phone, up came Apple CarPlay. So that's always a win for me. That starts me off as a bit of a fan of it. But it had loads of room. All the tactile stuff was just fine. It was great. And what I see about it is that I can see why people buy these things now. I can see why. I mean, there are better cars.
Over the competition?
No. As I say, there are better cars. But I can understand why, if I've always driven a Vauxhall, or you go along to one of these car supermarket places, and you sit and you go, oh, this is actually, you know, these part leather seats are quite nice. The steering wheel's a nice thing. My one real critique was that I found it was a bit tippy-toppy. And it wasn't that it rolled much, and I'm sure that was my perception, because I wasn't used to being in such a small vehicle.
No, but
so
they
high.
Look it, though. They do
it felt
look
really
that.
It felt sort of narrow and tall, especially when I was on the Autobahn following a German, following a colleague, who, having had minis all the time, ended up with a C-Class Merc, which I think was a little bit unfair. So I was following him. So he, of course, had no problem with that kind of stuff. He had a C180 or something. And I was trying to keep up with this with a 1.4 turbo petrol Mokka. But I have a better understanding of why people who are looking for that type of car buy those cars. It was nicer than any Corsa I've ever.
Good to know.
It was nicer than any Corsa I've ever driven. How's about that? I mean, that's a pretty key factor in it, really. Well, it is, because lots of these people are moving from a premium Corsa, and so they want something that's similar but a little bit taller and easier to get their artificial hips into and stuff. So, but no,
I think it's also it's also good that you've experienced it, because we do, no pun intended, mock some vehicles from afar. Without having had the opportunity to try them out and actually experience them, and then, you know, are we doing this on reputation? Are we doing this just because of we don't like the look or whatever? So, no, whenever you can experience any different car, I think it's a good thing to do.
Yeah. Well, I agree completely, and it's one of the nice things about unofficial test cars is that you don't get a choice. It's not like when we go to SMMT and you make a beeline for the cars that you actually would like to drive.
Yes.
So, yeah. So yeah, I was pleasantly. I mean, gear shift aside.
How much is one of those, by the way?
I don't know. I haven't.
Do you know how much one of those would be?
By the end of the show, I will know.
Okay.
Okay. By the time we finish recording, I will know.
No problem.
Anyway, that takes us on from Car Test Corner to... that's not the official name.
Who knew we'd have such a corner?
I know. It's one of those weird things. Car testing is not something we do a lot of. This week's list of the week comes from Richard Bremner, I think, at Autocar, and it is the cars with the shortest production runs. And it's good because Richard Bremner, because it's varied. I mean, most of them, to be honest, you'll look at them and go, yeah, so what? And a lot of them tend to be Chevrolets, actually, because of course Chevrolet renewed quite a lot of its Chevrolet Europe Chevrolet Europe range, and then was shut down, basically. I mean, mercifully, it means that we have all forgotten vehicles like the Chevrolet Epica out there, which is no great loss to humanity, though. But there's many others that we've also managed to blot from our minds for being not the greatest cars ever, like the Renault Fluence EV and the Renault Koleos.
I knew someone who had one of them.
A Koleos.
Yes.
A Samsung. It's even Korean designed and Korean built. Sorry.
Yeah, it was somebody that's not a massive petrol head, as you'd imagine.
you wouldn't be if you're...
And fitted their needs price-wise.
Yeah. I'm sure. Sorry, that's all I can say to that, which is like, gosh, they must have been desperate. The Suzuki...
Well, further down the list, actually.
Suzuki Kizashi.
Yeah, you're about to mention it. Yeah, I was going to say, driving down to the southwest, I saw one of those towing a caravan other way.
But they were meant to be really good cars. Now, I passed one which wasn't towing a caravan. I passed one which wasn't towing a caravan on Friday. So there were two of them on the M6 when there's only 332 left. But it was around from 2012 to 2013. Loads of stuff. If you want a reminder of some of the awfulness, actually, that's been around. The Chrysler Sebring, Dodge Avenger, Dodge Journey, Dodge Nitro. God, there's been some awful rot sold in this country, hasn't there? Thank you. Then have a look. It's nice and varied. There is everything in there, from the TVR Sagaris to the Vauxhall Sintra, a vehicle that old Top Gear even covered in manure because they declared it did so badly in the JD Power test results, if I remember rightly, that rebadged GM North America vehicle. Came in quite roundingly last. So go have a little look. Look, great stuff. There's great in the awful, actually. Mercedes Veneo. Yes. Oh, little Toyota Urban Cruiser. My dad's got one. He loves it. There you go. Yes, go take a little look. I'm still scrolling. There are many, many vehicles in the list. There's probably 30, 40, which is why we're not going through in a huge amount of detail.
No. I think we're on to the and finally.
We are. Speak slowly, because I still don't have that price yet.
And finally.
Yeah, not that slowly.
No. There's going to be a new exhibition to mark half a century of Gordon Murray cars. And this is going to be held by Gordon Murray Design. So they're putting this show together. So anyone who's a fan of that, or a fan of his work, you know, the variety of work and the variety of the parts of the motoring world he's been involved in, must be... smacking their lips in anticipation of going to see that. However, you can't.
Yeah, this is a real shame, because I would love to go see this.
No, it's invitation only, apparently. And we keep checking, and we will continue to check our letterboxes. But I'm guessing we won't be on the invitation, which is a shame, because we are big fans of the last two designs that have come out.
Well, I've been big fans of many of his cars, amongst others.
But I mean, we have been very vocal about the last two, because we've had a podcast in that time. if you remember the Ox, which we talked about last week on its crowdfunding tour of the UK.
Yep.
We think that's a brilliant idea.
Can we have a link to that?
And then there was the
Shell.
Yes, I will do. I will have a link to that in the show notes. And the Shell concept vehicle, showcasing a different design technologies.
Based on the T25 well. So, and stuff, yeah.
Yeah. So, obviously, it's going to be fantastic, because he has touched so much of the motion world, whether directly or whether as an inspiration for people, or when I say inspiration, I mean copied by people and his ideas. And he seems quite driven when he's got an idea, and he follows it through and pursues it, which is interesting in itself, particularly in the motoring industry.
Yes, it's very difficult to do that, but he's been very lucky to be in a position where he could do that kind of stuff. Yeah, awesome. It's a real shame we can't get to see it. It's not open to the public. because that would be something I'd go see. The other thing that finishes tomorrow, so if you listen to this first thing in the morning, you might still be able to go see it, are the 8 Great Roles from last week. It's very, very short, and I'm not going to be able to go see it, sadly. I've got a price.
You're not bitter about that at all.
Now, I've got a price for the equivalent Vauxhall spec, which is a Vauxhall Mocha X Elite Nav. It comes in, brace yourselves, ladies and gentlemen, at £25,180. So only about £1,000 less than a Toyota Yaris GRMN.
Which is like for like comparison.
Not at all.
You hope.
All I'm saying is the Toyota Yaris GRMN is an awesome bargain.
25 grand.
It's 25 grand, yeah. Nobody will ever pay 25 grand, though. Come on. No.
You will if you pay monthly.
Oh, you will do if you pay monthly. That's private by... I can go to the finance calculator. Hang on. Dum, da, da, dum, 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 dum. This is thrilling listening.
So, a question, or possibly homework for the listeners, is, you know, how does that tie in with the equivalent? Well, the Seat Ateca is an equivalent of that. The Ford...
No, not the Ateca. It's the new littler one.
Okay, so it would be the Ford Eco Boost then?
Ford don't really have an equivalent, because the Eco Boost is surely not the Eco Boost. The Eco Boost is... I mean, the thing about the Mocha is that it is at least... It has at least been built and I'm going to get in so much trouble. It has at least been built for first world countries. The EcoBoost, unless there have been some significant improvements over the reviews that I've read of it in the past, and again, it fits into that category of cars that I don't run to go. EcoSport is what we're talking about. The EcoSport range starts from 15.
The Boost is the engine.
Yeah, I only remembered because I saw this. The EcoSport range starts from about 15,000. The Mocha starts from about from in the early 20s, 21-ish. So, you know, there's a significant difference in price there. A lot of it's to do with where it's built. The Eco Sport is really meant for emerging markets. Emerging markets, you know, it's like more upmarket than a Renault Kwid in India, is what I'm thinking there.
Okay. Well, I think that's the difference. Listening to you click through Auto Trader or something.
No. What
cars price comparison?
Do you think that could actually be the basis for a new podcast? Is watching? There's probably a YouTube audience for it, isn't it? It's like the equivalent of watching gamers.
There's definitely a special edition in it.
Do you know what it is? It's the equivalent.
Let's call out random names and see how quickly Alan can find the right spec.
No. This is the car nerd equivalent of watching people play Minecraft. Or watching people stream computer games. We should get a Twitch channel. A Twitch channel which lets us so you can watch us build cars on car configurators. How's about that?
Well, what? We need a Twitch channel or something for when we charge around Britain.
No, we don't need a Twitch channel for that, I don't think. That's what we'll...
What are we going to put out? Periscopes?
Let's see what we've got at various places before we promise too much.
I
would imagine there's going to be some YouTubes, anything at all, as much as we can, because at least one of us is going to be bored at every single point in this whole trip from the passenger seat. Or sucking through our teeth watching the other one drive.
So no, I'll be asleep.
It could be the end of a beautiful friendship, everyone. There might be no more.
Why? Which friend of yours are you taking along?
Yeah, shut up. I've got a whole load. This is great because it'll mean we get through so many Audible books. We have an Audible offer too, everyone. Anyway, I should really be doing the show ending, shouldn't I, rather than sitting here yakking.
You should, really. We are prattling on
I
here.
I should, yes. Sorry. Sorry, everyone. But yeah, that's
it's extra bonus
we'll
if
more
you've listened
as,
this
as
long.
We know about it. It is, yes. Well done. Congratulations on your staying power. But we're going to put a stop to that and remind you that between now and next week, you can give us any feedback and share your thoughts with the show at Motoring Podcast on Twitter and Instagram, on Facebook, and on the contact page of motoringpodcast.com, the hub of all our activities. Remember our Patreon, available at motoringpodcast.com/support. And if you can't do that, then leave a review or rating on iTunes or the podcast player of choice. Those ratings, those reviews really do make a difference. Andrew, best way to get in touch with you?
Best way to get in touch with me would be via Twitter. If you search for Crack Windscreen, you will find me there. And Alan, if people would like to know how a variable transmission works,
you mean how, like,
particularly a Subaru one, what is the best way for them to get in touch with you?
The best way is actually to look up Subaru Lineatronic on YouTube, where you will find the official Subaru video of how a continuously variable transmission works, and it will be better than my description because people laughed at it the last time, although they also said I was correct. In the meantime, if you've got anything else that you want to tell me, comment, question, disagree with, whatever, then I'll be on Twitter at AJPBradley, B-R-A-D-L-E-Y. We'll both be back next week. Andrew, rear view this week. There is, isn't there?
Yes. Yes.
Sorry,
yes,
I missed
there
that.
Are, yes, there is. There will be three more, and then there will be a brief break.
Okay.
Because of holidays and things.
Fair enough. So, yes, review on Friday. If you haven't listened to last week's yet, it is former Fifth Gear presenter, motoring journalist, and current Top Gear America host, and also writes for Top Gear UK magazine, Tom Wookie Ford, as opposed to Tom Makes Posh Suits Ford. As I say, we'll be back next week. Until then, I've been Alan Bradley.
I've been Andrew Clues.
And safe motoring.